This is Audible.
Listening Library presents Al Capone Does My Shirts by Jennifer Choldenko. Read for you by Kirby Hayborn. Part 1. 1. Devil's Island. Friday, January 4th, 1935. Today I moved to a 12-acre rock covered with cement, topped with bird turd, and surrounded by water. Alcatraz sits smack in the middle of the bay, so close to the city of San Francisco, I can hear them call the score on a baseball game on Marina Green. Okay, not that close, but still. I'm not the only kid who lives here. There's my sister, Natalie, except she doesn't count. And there are 23 other kids who live on the island because their dads work as guards, or cooks, or doctors, or electricians for the prison like my dad does. Plus, there are a ton of murderers, rapists, hitmen, con men, stick-up men, embezzlers, connivers, burglars, kidnappers, and maybe even an innocent man or two, though I doubt it. The convicts we have are the kind other prisons don't want. I never knew prisons could be picky, but I guess they can. You get to Alcatraz by being the worst of the worst. Unless you're me. I came here because my mother said I had to. I want to be here like I want poison oak on my private parts. But apparently nobody cares because now I'm Moose Flanagan, Alcatraz Island boy. Also, my sister can go to the Esther P. Marinoff School, where kids have macaroni salad in their hair and wear their clothes inside out, and there isn't a chalkboard or a book in sight. Not that I've ever been to the Esther P. Marinoff, but all of Natalie's schools are like this. I peek out the front window of our new apartment and look up to see a little glass room lit bright in the dark night. This is the dock guard tower, a popcorn stand on stilts where somebody's dad sits with enough firepower to blow us all to smithereens. The only guns on the island are up high in the towers or the catwalks, because one flick of the wrist and a gun carried by a guard is a gun carried by a criminal. The keys to all the boats are kept up there for the same reason. They even have a crapper in each tower so the guards don't have to come down to take a leak. Besides the guard tower, there's water all around, black and shiny like tar. A full moon cuts a white path across the bay while the wind blows, making something creak and a buoy clang in the distance. My dad is out there too. He has guard duty in another tower somewhere on the island. My dad's an electrician, for Pete's sake. What's he doing playing prison guard? My mom is in her room unpacking, and Natalie's sitting on the kitchen floor, running her hands through her button box. She knows more about those buttons than it seems possible to know. If I hide one behind my back, she can take one look at her box and name the exact button I have. Nat, you okay? I sit down on the floor next to her. Moose and Natalie go on a train. Moose and Natalie eat meatloaf sandwich. Moose and Natalie look out the window. Yeah, we did all that. And now we're here with some swell fellows like Al Capone and Machine Gun Kelly.
Natalie Flanagan's whole family.
Well, I wouldn't exactly say they're family, more like next-door neighbors, I guess.
Moose and Natalie go to school, she says.
Yep, but not the same school, remember? You're going to this nice place called the Esther P. Marinoff. I try to sound sincere.
Nice place,
she repeats, stacking one button on top of another. I've never been good at fooling Natalie. She knows me too well. When I was 5, I was kind of a runt. Smallest kid of all my cousins, shortest kid in my kindergarten class, and on my block, too. Back then, people called me by my real name, Matthew. Natalie was the first person to call me Moose. I swear I started growing to fit the name that very day. Now I'm 5'11½", as tall as my mom, and a good 2 inches taller than my dad.
My father tells people I've grown so much, he's going to put my supper into pickle jars and sell it under the name Incredible Growth Formula. I think about going in my room now, but it smells like the inside of an old lunch bag in there. My bed's a squeaky old army cot. When I sit down, it sounds like dozens of mice are dying an ugly death. There's no phonograph in this apartment, no washing machine, no phone. There's a radio cabinet, but someone yanked the workings out. Who gutted the radio anyway? They don't let the criminals in here, do they? So, I'm a little jumpy, but anybody would be. Even the silence here is strange. It's quiet like something you can't hear is happening. I think about telling my best friend Pete about this place. It's the Devil's Island. Doo-doo-doo, Pete would say in a deep, spooky voice like they do on the radio. Devil's Island. Doo-doo-doo, I whisper, just like Pete. But without him, it doesn't seem funny. Not funny at all. Okay, that's it. I'm sleeping with my clothes on. Who wants to face a convicted felon in your pajamas? 2. Errand Boy. Saturday, January 5th, 1935. When I wake up, I feel kind of foolish, having slept with my shoes on and my baseball bat under the covers with me. My mom's banging around in the tiny hall outside my room. I stick the bat under my bed. "Where's Dad?" I ask. "Right here," my dad answers from the living room. He's sitting on the floor with Natalie, holding a pile of buttons in each hand. "Dad, could you show me the cell house, and then maybe could we play ball?" I sound like I'm 6 and a half now, but I can't help it. He's been gone forever, and I hardly got to see him at all yesterday. It's lonely in my family when he's not around. His smile seems to lose its pink. He puts Natalie's buttons down in two careful piles, gets up and brushes his uniform off. I follow him into the kitchen. "You're not working today, are you?" "I'm having a devil of a time setting up extra circuits in the laundry." "Yeah, but you worked last night." My mom squeezes by to run her hands under the tap. "Your father has two jobs here, Moose, electrician and guard." "Two," Natalie calls from the living room. "Two jobs, two." "Doesn't anyone in this family believe in private conversations?" "I could help you," I offer. He shakes his head. "You're not allowed in there. Convict areas are off limits to you kids," he says. "I'm not a kid. I'm taller than you are." "Go ahead, rub it in," he laughs. "But at least I don't have those big feet either. They're an affliction, those feet." He grabs my head and knocks on it. "I haven't seen you for 3 whole months, I say.
2 months, 22 days, 22 days, Natalie calls out.
"That's right, sweet pea, you tell him," my father calls back.
"I'll bet you took Natalie out this morning, didn't you?" The question comes shooting out before I can stop it.
"Oh, for goodness sake, Moose."
My mother looks up from where she's jammed in the corner, scrubbing the icebox.
"You weren't even up."
"That isn't fair," I say, though I know better.
"Don't talk to me about fair, young man. Don't get me started on that one."
My mother glares at me. "I'm sorry, Moose," my father says. He reaches for his officer's hat and settles it on his head. "There's nothing I'd like better than to spend the day with you. You know that." His eyes look at me, then quick away.
"Wait, wait, wait. You're leaving now?"
I ask. He groans. "Afraid so. But there will be plenty of time to spend together. I promise, buddy. Okay?" He smiles, kisses my mom and Nat goodbye, and heads for the door. I watch him walk by the front window, his head bobbing like his foot hurts. My mom glances at her watch.
"My goodness, is it that time already? Moose, I need you to watch Natalie while I take the boat to the city. I have to get groceries and arrange an ice delivery."
my mother says.
Ice?
I ask. We can't afford an electric refrigerator. We got to keep this one. She taps the old ice box.
They have a grocery downstairs, though, right?
Doesn't have much. Try to do some unpacking while I'm gone. 11, 12, and 13 are all your stuff.
My mother points to the crates, each numbered by Natalie. She takes off her apron and puts on her coat, her gloves, and her hat.
You're leaving now, too? I ask. I'll be back as soon as I can. Take good care of her, okay?
My mom grabs my arm and squeezes it. I know she's thinking about what happened on the train yesterday. I had gone to take a leak, and when I came back, Nat was kicking and screaming. She pulled a curtain off the rod and sent her button box flying down the aisle. My mom had her arms around Nat, trying to keep her from hurting anyone. The conductor and the motorman were yelling. People were staring. One lady was taking pictures. My mom finally got her calmed down by sitting on her, right in the middle of the train aisle. I don't know which was more embarrassing, Natalie's behavior or my mother's. Sometimes Nat's tantrums go on and on for days and nothing makes them stop. It's impossible to know what will set her off. She looks pretty peaceful now, though.
Sure, Mom. I follow her to the door. I didn't really mean what I said about it not being fair that Natalie got to go out with Dad this morning. I didn't. You know I didn't.
Mom?
She sighs.
All right, Moose. Just keep your eye on Natalie, okay?
I watch her leave. A haze rises from the bay like a wall of gray, closing me off from everything. In the kitchen, I find a casserole dish I don't recognize. Thought you might enjoy some manicotti. Looking forward to meeting you. B. Trixel, the card says. The manicotti tastes like big fat spaghetti with pizza inside. I'm going for fourths, or maybe it's fifths, when I hear the knock.
Don't answer it, I yell to Natalie as I wade through the boxes to the front door. The last thing I want is to meet new kids when Natalie's around.
New people don't understand about her. They just don't.
Open up,
a girl cries. It's a little kid, a short person anyway. That's all I can make out through the window.
No,
I call back. But too late. Natalie is already there. She has both hands on the knob and all her weight rocked back on her heels, trying to get the door open.
Don't open it!
I shove my weight against the door.
Come on, you know you're gonna,
the girl outside says. Oh, great. I have little Eleanor Roosevelt on one side of the door and Natalie the screamer on the other. What they say about females being the weaker sex is the biggest lie in the world. It doesn't matter that I weigh more than both of them put together. I know when I'm beat. I let Natalie open the door. The girl outside has black curly hair that's flat on one side, as if she slept on it. She's missing half of her teeth. The ones she has seem either too large or too small for her mouth.
How old are you?
She demands.
12.
No, you're not,
she says, walking right in without bothering to ask.
Why would I lie about how old I am?
She bites her lip, like she's thinking about this.
You got a big neck.
You're supposed to get a long nose if you lie, not a big neck.
No,
she shakes her head as if she's absolutely certain I'm wrong.
And you're what? 7?
7 1/4. Hello, Natalie.
The girl smiles, her big tooth, little tooth, gap tooth smile.
Your dad told me all about her,
she whispers. We both look at Natalie. Her hair is like mine, brown and blonde, all mixed up like birdseed. Different eyes, though. Mine are brown. Hers are green like the marbles nobody likes to trade away. But the way she holds her mouth too open and her shoulders uneven and one hand clamps down the other. People know. They always know.
How old is she?
The girl whispers. 10, I answer. Natalie's age is always 10. Every year my mom has a party for her, and she turns 10 again. My mom started counting Nat's age this screwy way a long time ago. It was just easier to have her younger than me. Then my mother could be happy for each new thing I did, without it being another thing Natalie couldn't do. "What's your name, anyway?" I ask.
"Teresa Madaman. I'm supposed to show you around. You haven't seen anything yet, have you?"
"We just got here last night."
"Natalie, come on. We're going now. Run, get her coat,"
Teresa orders. I'm big as a linebacker, and a 7-year-old girl treats me like her errand boy. Does she smell weakness on me? Still, I want to get a look at this weird little island. And what do I care what a bunch of criminals think anyway? I scribble a note to my mom to tell her we've gone out and prop the paper between the ketchup and the cod liver oil. "Come on, Nat. It's not everybody who gets to live down the street from thieves and murderers, you know." 3. Trick Monkey. Same day, Saturday, January 5th, 1935. The first thing I see when I walk out the door is the guard tower. I wonder what you're supposed to do here. Should I wave? Teresa pays no attention. The tower might as well be a tree for all she cares. She leads us to the stairwell. Natalie's walking behind us with her head down, dragging her left foot on the edge of every step as if she's marking it with her toe. I want to take her hand to make sure she keeps up, but nobody touches Natalie.
"First, we're going to the morgue,"
Teresa announces with a little skip. "Sure. I've been to hundreds of morgues, thousands of them, in fact. Dead criminals. Don't I get to meet any live ones?" I ask.
"We're not really supposed to talk to the alive ones, but looking for dead guys is my job. Piper said."
"Dead criminal checker. Sounds like an important position to me. And who is Piper, anyway?" I ask.
"Piper? She's Warden Williams' daughter. She's bossy."
"Just what I need. Another bossy girl."
"Oh, no, I almost forgot."
Teresa claps her hands, then digs in her pocket for a card folded in fours.
"I made this for you. Annie did the words. I made the map all by myself."
"And who is Annie?"
"Annie's Annie. She's 12. She helps me with stuff."
"Are there any boys on this island?"
"Jimmy and..."
She counts on her fingers.
11 little boys who are 5, 4, 3, 1, and 0.
"Zero?"
"Not 1 year yet. Do you want to know their names?"
I shake my head, but too late. Teresa is already rattling off the name of every little boy here. "Thanks, Teresa." I cram the card in my pocket.
"Hey!"
She hollers in my face.
"You didn't read it."
She holds out her hand and wiggles her fingers.
"Give."
I hand the card back, and Teresa reads it to me.
"Alphonse Capone, a.k.a. Scarface, Big Al, Snorky. Born in New York, January 17th, 1899. Family, wife named May, son named Sonny."
Teresa reads really well for a little kid, except it doesn't seem like she can walk and read at the same time. Now we're at a complete standstill on the steep road that leads to the top of the island. "Couldn't we do this after the morgue?" I ask. She ignores me. Clearly, there's no stopping her until she's read every last word.
"Business. Bootlegging gangster mob boss. Favorite colors. Canary yellow and pea green. Favorite jewelry. $50,000 diamond pinky ring. Favorite weapon. Thompson machine gun. Favorite crime. Dinner party of death. Invites lieutenants in his organization known to have double-crossed him to a party. After dessert, Al's men lock the doors and Capone beats the traitors to death with a baseball bat."
"A baseball bat?"
"Favorite word for murder. Rub out. Often in front of many witnesses who then develop gangster amnesia. Sent to jail for tax evasion. Other stuff. Rigged elections.
opened first soup kitchen in Chicago. Likes silk underwear.
What is this guy? Nuts?
Current home, Alcatraz Island. And that's not all we have here either, Teresa says when I look up. There's Machine Gun Kelly, who happens to be a world-famous kidnapper, and Roy Gardner, who has escaped 110 times, but not from Alcatraz. Not yet, anyway. Oh, we have everyone who is bad, except Bonnie and Clyde on account of their being dead, she says.
A truck horn beeps and we move off the road. A guard in a dark gray uniform like my dad's is behind the wheel. He brings the truck to a squeaky halt and cranks down the window.
I glance back at Natalie, who has been so quiet I almost forgot she was there. She's looking at the ground as if she lost something. Her arms are down at her sides, not up high like a chipmunk's, the way they usually are.
They Cam Flanagan's kids? The guard asks Teresa.
Teresa nods.
Yes, sir, Mr. Trixel, she says.
Where you headed?
Piper's house, sir.
Mr. Trixel nods.
Make a beeline there, Teresa. You know the rules.
Yes, sir.
The guard's eyes scan me and Nat. If he gets there's anything different about her, he doesn't let on. The brakes squeal as the truck inches down the steep road. Now, the cell house is looming over us like the world's biggest school for bad boys, the kind of place where guys go in and never come out. I wish Pete were here. Pete would love this. Teresa chatters on about why she thinks Capone will really like her when she meets him, which clearly she hasn't done yet. The road cuts back away from the water tower. We follow it a short way up to a little cottage. It looks cute, almost like a playhouse. The sign above the glass door reads, Morgue. Inside, there's a bucket on the floor and a metal box. What do they do in morgues anyway? Are they like bread boxes for dead bodies? Or do they label stuff in special compartments? Baskets for fingers? Drawers for toes?
So this is it, Teresa says. Only they keep it locked.
She pulls on the door handle to show me.
Yeah, I see. Maybe we should, move on. Didn't you tell the guard guy we were going to Piper's house?
I don't like getting in trouble. I was born responsible. It's a curse. Then another girl's crusty voice comes out from the shadows behind the morgue.
What's the matter with your sister?
My chest gets tight. The blood rushes to my head. The girl comes around the side of the building, flipping a flat yellow hat on her finger like a pizza. My face turns red just seeing her. She's a looker. If Pete were here, he'd whistle.
She retarded? The girl asks.
None of your business, I tell her. The girl has freckles and full lips like a movie star. She winds her long dark hair around her finger and looks at me through half-shut eyelids. Something about the way she does this makes me glance down to make sure my fly is buttoned. When I look up again, she's staring at Natalie.
Stop looking at her like that, I say.
That's Piper, remember? I told you about her,
Teresa says.
So, not retarded. Stupid then?
Piper asks.
Look, could we drop this already?
I'm just asking a simple question, Piper says.
Not in front of Natalie, I whisper. She shrugs and walks behind the morgue. Teresa and I follow. Nat stays put.
How would you like it if I asked, are you stupid?
I would just say no.
Piper flips her hair behind her shoulder. No, she's not stupid, I say.
Prove it.
I clench my fists. I'd really like to give this Piper girl a pounding.
See, I knew she was retarded, Piper tells Teresa.
Will you kindly just shut up?
I roar louder than I intend. They both stare at me.
Follow me.
I walk back around to the front of the morgue.
When's your birthday, Piper? I ask.
November 16th.
1922?
Yep.
Natalie, what day of the week was Piper born?
Thursday,
Nat says without looking up. That right? I ask Piper. Piper doesn't answer, but her eyes open wider. She chews at her bottom lip.
What else can she do?
She asks. She's not a trick monkey.
She'd never make it as a trick monkey. She only has one trick,
Piper says.
487 times 6,421 is 3,127,027,
Nat says. Everything is quiet except the sound of gulls squawking overhead and wind rattling a window somewhere. Natalie inspects the ground. It's almost as if she hasn't said anything.
How much is 28 times 478?
Piper asks.
13,384, Nat answers. Okay, so she's good in math. But something is wrong with her,
Piper says.
What is your problem?
I shout. Teresa motions for us to step away from Natalie.
Natalie lives in her own world. That's what Mr. Flanagan said,
Teresa whispers. She takes a jar of jam from her pocket, unscrews the lid, and offers us some. We shake our heads no, and she dips an already purple-stained finger inside.
Sometimes it's a good world, and sometimes it's a bad world, and sometimes she can get out, and sometimes she can't.
Piper snorts.
Sounds to me like she's just plain crazy,
she says in a low voice.
My dad isn't going to like this. He's not going to like it one bit. He always says the cons in the bug cage are the scariest ones, because you never know what they'll do.
I get a sinking feeling in my gut. There were 237 electricians who applied for the job my dad got. If it were me, I'd have kept my mouth shut about having a daughter like Natalie. What if the warden doesn't know about her? She's leaving in a week or two, going to boarding school. She won't be around here at all. You probably won't ever see her again, I say quickly. Piper raises her eyebrows.
I'm expected to tell him stuff like this. He depends on me to find out things.
She places her flat hat on her head and begins hiking up the steep road toward the cell house.
Wait, can we come? Can we?
Teresa calls after her.
Good idea, Piper calls over her shoulder. Then my father can meet Natalie himself.
My stomach sinks. How am I supposed to know if Nat's a big secret or not? Nobody tells me anything.
Natalie,
Piper calls out sweetly.
Would you like to meet the warden?
Nat says nothing.
Hey, come on!
Teresa motions with her whole arm.
Piper said it was okay.
I'm going back, Teresa. My mom will be home soon.
Oh, no,
Teresa cries.
You haven't seen anything yet.
I shake my head. Maybe tomorrow. Teresa stamps her foot. I can't help smiling at this.
I'm sorry, Teresa. Okay, we'll finish tomorrow,
Teresa says in a small voice. We gotta go back, I tell Natalie. She doesn't look up, doesn't seem to hear. This way. I motion for her to follow. She ignores me. Oh, swell. Now Nat's acting up.
Come on, Nat.
I try walking down the hill, hoping she'll follow. She doesn't. I walk back up to the morgue and sit down on the cement slab by a little dab of something red. Blood? Or is it Teresa's jam? I figure I'll just wait Nat out when I hear footsteps on the road.
Natalie, come on,
I plead.
Moose!
My mom's voice. She's half running in her high heels.
What in heaven's name are you doing out here?
My mom stops, her chest heaving from the climb. She looks at me, then Nat, then me again.
What happened?
She asks. It's okay, Mom. Nat's fine.
I didn't know where you were.
Her voice goes up and down like hiccups. She grips her arms like if she doesn't, they won't stay on.
It scared me when you were gone like that.
I left a note. She nods. I don't know if this is because she saw my note or because she didn't. I touch her elbow and try to sound like Dad. Everything's going to be all right. My mother nods short and fast. She pushes at the corner of first one eye, then the other, and keeps nodding. Nodding and nodding and nodding. 4. American Laugh-Nosed Beat. Sunday, January 6th, 1935. The next morning when I get up, I'm happy to find my father at the table, reading the paper. I can feel how pleased he is to see me. This isn't something you can fake.
Hey, he says.
My mother is checking my sister's suitcase. I can't believe she's going today. I thought it was a week away at least. Nat has the kitchen chair pulled into the living room, wedged between three crates. Hey, Natalie, the sun get up okay this morning? I ask like I do every morning. She never answers, which used to really bug me. I hate being the brother of a stone. One day last year, I got so mad, I just walked right by her. Didn't say anything, not one word. That day, after I left for school, my mom said Natalie sat outside my room and cried for 2 straight hours. Natalie isn't a crier, she's a screamer. You never see her cry for plain old hurt. I'd say my mom made it all up, but she didn't know I'd snubbed Natalie. My mom had no idea why Natalie had cried. Now I ask Natalie about the sun every morning, and it only bothers me a little when she doesn't answer.
So what would you like for breakfast on this very special day? My mother asks her.
Lemon cake, Natalie says. She says this every day, too. And every day my mom says,
Silly sweet pea, you can't have lemon cake for breakfast.
Why not? On a special day like today, lemon cake sounds like a fine idea. What do you think, Moose? My mom asks.
Sure, I say. My voice comes out high like a girl's. I never know whether I'm going to sound like Mickey Mouse or the giant on top of the beanstalk. Natalie turns all the way around and looks me straight in the eye in that weird way she has of suddenly being present after weeks of being somewhere else. Don't look at me. This wasn't my idea. If it were up to me, we'd be in Santa Monica right this very minute, I say under my breath. My father reads Natalie headlines from the newspaper, adding numbers to every one. Work resumes on the Golden Gate Bridge. 103 men are put back to work. 2 quit, 7 scratch their heads, 5 have their feet up, 2 eat sausages for supper, 3 do not...
Breakfast! My mother calls.
Natalie holds her face 2 inches from the plate. She eats so fast, it gives me a stomach ache. When my dad's not around, I don't eat with her.
Natalie Flanagan's whole family, Nat says when I sit down.
I wonder if she knows what's happening. We've built the Esther P. Marinoff up like it's quite the place, like maybe the King and Queen of England are sending their kids there too. But somehow in all this talking, we ignored the major thing. You don't come home from the Esther P. Marinoff. Every morning when the sun comes up, that's where Natalie will be. My father wipes his wide mouth with his napkin.
What fun you're going to have, Natalie, with kids your own age.
What age is that, I wonder. But I know what he means. Maybe she'll meet other kids like her. Maybe they'll recognize each other and communicate in their own peculiar way. When my mom has Nat ready to go, my father picks up her suitcase, hands Natalie her button box, and opens the door.
Moose, my mom says as if she's just now noticed I'm here, I don't think you need to come along.
Fine with me, I don't want to go anyway. I don't look at her, or my dad, or Natalie.
Helen! My father's voice has a sting to it.
I just didn't think he'd want to, Cam, my mother says.
Of course Moose is coming.
He hands Nat's suitcase to me and pats me on the back. We can't do this without him. This reminds me of the time when I was 6 and my mom shipped me off to live at Graham's.
She packed every pair of underwear I owned, and she made it all seem like a big treat. When we got there, my gram had an awful scowl on her face. She gave me a big hug and glared at my mother like I'd never seen her do. When my mom left, I heard Gram and Ed talking.
Some cockamamie psychiatrist decides the problem is Natalie doesn't get enough attention, and Helen ships him off. Our Matthew! I'm happy as a pig in mud to have him here, but it's a darn fool thing. What child doesn't have a brother or sister? Half the world has 7 or 8. Having a brother didn't make Natalie the way she is. One look at the two of them together and that big-shot psychiatrist would have known that. He's the one ought to have his head examined. It's going to make Nat sicker just having Moose gone.
Early the next morning, my father woke me.
Get your pillow, Moose, he said, snapping the buckles on my suitcase. We're going home.
We're walking down to the dock now. Natalie is going extra slow. I worry we'll miss the boat, but maybe that's her plan. I like to think all these years have been part of her plan, too. And one day, Nat will tell me it's all a crazy game she made up to see if we really loved her. My father jogs ahead. Yesterday, the boatman told us,
"We don't wait for nobody. Even God himself has to get down here on time."
But somehow, the big ex-army steamship called the Frank M. Cox is still there. My mother walks through the snitch box, a metal detector designed to make sure no one is bringing guns on the island.
This new school is a good opportunity for you, Natalie, my mother tells her as I watch the boat guy unwind a rope as thick as my arm from the cleat. You are such a lucky girl to have this chance.
Natalie says nothing. Her eyes are trained on a gull wiggling a potato chip out from the wood slat bench. I look up at another bird high in the blue sky, and another skimming low over the green-blue sea. My father has a book with him, McGregor's Illustrated Animal Book. He's brought it because it has a good index. Nothing pleases Natalie more than having him read the index of a book to her.
American leaf-nosed bat, page 48, my father reads. American quail, page 232. American spiny rat, page 188.
Tons of gulls are flying above our boat. We watch them, Natalie and I. Natalie is rocking more than usual, but it doesn't look out of place here. The boat rocks anyway.
I count 229 birds, I say, pointing at the gulls.
Bad moose, Natalie says. 9 birds, 9.
I smile at her.
I count 47 people on the deck.
Bad moose, 11 peoples, 11.
Natalie loves catching my mistakes. Once when I was 7 or 8, she started bringing books to me. Big old ones like the dictionary and the encyclopedia. She'd turn to the back and plunk the book on my lap. I couldn't figure out what she wanted. One day, just to get her to go away, I started reading the page she had opened. It was a history book, and the index was full of names of people and places. I got to this one, Machu Picchu, and I said something like,
Mac who pick you.
Bad moose, she said. Machu Picchu.
I thought she was nuts until my mom informed me that this is how it is pronounced. My mother went straight to the library and checked out a big stack of history books for Natalie. But it didn't take long to realize it wasn't history Natalie was interested in. It's indexes she loves. Any subject will do. We still don't have any idea how she learned the correct pronunciation of Machu Picchu, though. We're coming into the dock in San Francisco now.
12 minutes to get to Alcatraz, 20 years to get back, my dad says the cons say.
We sit a minute, watching a church-going family walk down the gangplank. The toddler goes backward, hanging on the handrail, and cautiously moving his squat legs down plank by plank. Everyone smiles at how careful he is.
Going to be an insurance man when he grows up, his dad winks at my mom. All right, troops, move him out, my father says.
But my mom seems stuck in her seat. She's staring at the toddler, who is walking across the dock, holding tight to his mom's hand. My mom blows her nose with her handkerchief. She's blinking fast, trying to keep back her tears. When Natalie sees this, she curls up in a tight little ball on the wood slat seat and will not move. My mother pulls herself together and tries to sound cheerful again.
Natalie, honey, I have a little cold, that's all, sweet pea. Now come on, sweetheart. This is a wonderful day.
Her voice sounds fake, and Natalie knows it. She pulls her knees tighter into herself. My father whispers that he hopes he won't have to carry her. He squats down on one knee and talks to Nat for a long time. The boatman nods to my mother and taps his wrist to signal time to get off. My mother fusses with her gloves, pulls her hat brim low, and walks across the deck to talk to him. I shift my weight from one leg to the other and back. Finally, my father's head pops up. He looks at me.
Moose, can you get her up?
He asks.
Everyone who is getting off needs to get off!
The boatman booms as people begin boarding for the trip back to Alcatraz. I look around, searching for an idea. I grab the book and flip to the back. American Laugh-Nosed Beat, page 3000, I say. Natalie is still curled up tight, but her head cocks a fraction of an inch. Australian Quill, page 200, I say. Now she makes a noise deep in her throat and bolts up.
No, Moose. American Leaf-Nosed Bat, page 48. American Quail, page 232, she says.
I take a step toward the gangplank. American Spiny Rot, page 18, I say.
Bad, Moose. Bad, bad, bad. American Spiny Rat, page 188.
She shakes her head, but she is standing now, following me. Step by step, page by page, I get her off the boat. Now my dad has the brown suitcase, my mom is smiling, and Natalie is next to me. She finds my hand. She grips my fingers together so hard it hurts. Natalie has held my hand maybe once before in my whole life. Why does she pick now for this? This is the right thing to do, I tell myself, but I don't believe it. This is another one of my mother's crazy ideas. I feel sick to my stomach. I want to pull my hand away, but I don't. I keep walking. Good Moose. Obedient Moose. I always do what I'm supposed to do.
5. Murderers darn my socks. Same day, Sunday, January 6th. 1935. I keep thinking about when my mom's second cousin, Mrs. McCraw, came to visit.
Put her in an asylum, Helen. It's the humane thing to do,
Mrs. McCraw said between bites of cinnamon nut cake. My mom turned ashen. She told Mrs. McCraw she wasn't welcome in our home ever again. Mrs. McCraw took giant gulps of air and tried to apologize, but my mom stood firm, holding the door open. She didn't say a word until Mrs. McCraw limped out, her handbag bumping against her side. After she was gone, my mom found Mrs. McCraw's knitting bag. She sent me running after her to give it back.
I can't help if your mom can't see the forest for the trees. She's got one good boy. Why not focus on him? But no, she goes on these wild goose chases. It's too bad the child is sick. But cut your losses. No use throwing good after bad.
I nodded then. I didn't mean to. Really, I didn't. My neck nodded without my telling it to. But once I'd nodded, I couldn't unnod. I was too stiff to move. When Mrs. McCraw drove off, I still had her knitting bag in my hand. The thing is, we didn't do that, right? We didn't put her away. The Esther P. Marinoff will help her, right?
When we get back, I tromp up the stairs to our apartment, wondering if Teresa's family has a radio that works. Then I see the note hanging from our door. Cam,
Send your boy up to talk to me at 1700 today. Warden Williams.
The warden?
I croak. My dad takes the note out of my hand.
Looks like it, he says.
Couldn't I do this tomorrow?
When the warden says jump, my father says, you ask how high.
Dad, we gotta talk.
Give me a little time to rest, then we'll play ball, then you'll go.
He winks at me. I don't remember ever seeing him look so tired. The extra guard duty shifts are killing him. It's too much work, and being a prison guard is the exact wrong job for him. He's too nice. My mother would make a much better jailer than my father.
I've just finished my book when my father comes out of his room with his glove and the ball in his hand. My mother is still sleeping. He closes the door as quietly as he can.
Doc?
He asks.
Yep.
I search for my glove. It's not in my room. Maybe it's in Natalie's. Lately, she's decided the glove is hers. The door to Nat's room is closed. I can't bring myself to open it. I glance back at my dad.
I'll get it,
he whispers. From the doorway, I see Nat's soft purple blanket in a tangled heap.
Why didn't my mom pack it? How will Nat go to sleep without it? I feel like marching into my parents' room and shaking my mom. How could you send her to that place without her blanket?
My dad finds the glove on a crate by her bed. He puts it under his arm and heads for the door.
Dad, what about her blanket? What if she needs it?
I think your mom was worried it would get lost. He presses his lips together so hard, they go white. Neither of us says anything as we walk down the stairs. The dock smells like sardines, and it's pretty deserted, unless you count the birds, which I don't because it makes me think about Natalie. We decide to throw parallel to 64 building, where we live. This way, if somebody misses, we aren't as likely to lose the ball in the bay or bust out any apartment windows. The gulls scatter to the dock posts and wood pilings at the water's edge. They sit, watching us like fans.
It's so nice to have my dad again.
I was angry at him for looking for a job up here, and angry all over again when he found one. I've been angry at my mom for making us do this, and at Pete and all my friends at home, because I had to move and they didn't. I've been mad at everyone except Natalie. I always try really hard not to get angry at her. Once, when I was little, I yelled at her for smashing a dugout I'd constructed out of cardboard, and my mom didn't speak to me for a month. My father told me having Natalie as a sister is like playing ball when you're 100 times better than your opponent. You'll always win, but it will make you feel like a louse. I didn't see what that had to do with my sister ruining my stuff and my mother going mute, but it was pretty clear that getting mad at Natalie was the one thing that would never be forgiven. My dad's not a great ball player, but he's a lot of fun to throw with because he's always trying something tricky. He sends a high ball I have to run like crazy for, then a fast, glove-pelting stinger, then a low burner. I know all his tricks. After a few minutes, when my arm is good and loose, I start talking.
So, I ask, how long we here?
My dad catches the ball and walks up closer so we don't have to shout. We live here now, Moose. You know that.
But what if I don't want to live here?
He shrugs. Nobody wants to come to Alcatraz, but at least you don't have a number printed on your back and no bracelets either.
Bracelets?
Handcuffs.
Oh.
I send him an easy ball with a high arc.
Natalie doesn't like it either. She doesn't like it one bit,
I say, although I know this is a cheap shot.
My father catches the ball and waits a beat before returning a stinger. I'm surprised how hard and fast it is. It stings my hand through my glove.
If you want to talk about yourself, that's fine, but I'm not going to discuss your sister.
Does the warden know?
Does the warden know what?
About Natalie.
Of course. What's he want to talk to me about, then?
Just wants to meet you, is my guess. It's decent of him to take the time to talk to you, Moose.
Have you met his daughter?
Piper, yes. Seems like quite a nice young lady.
I blow air out of my mouth and roll my eyes. He laughs.
The pretty ones are always trouble, Moose, but I think you can handle her.
He winks at me. She told me she was going to tell the warden about Natalie.
Like I said, he already knows.
She wasn't nice, I say.
Sounds to me like she was just trying to help out her dad. No crime there.
Tell me again why we can't go home.
We saw where that was going, Moose. Natalie sitting on Graham's back step, counting her buttons day after day. We wanted to see, just see, if there was another way. This school has skilled teachers working with these kids around the clock. It's an impressive place.
The gulls are starting to edge closer now. I stamp my foot and they scatter. You saw how she was when we left.
Change is hard. It's hard for you. It's hard for me. It's murder on your sister.
His voice breaks. You heard her screaming, Dad.
My dad's hands go up to block my words. Look, son, he interrupts. I can't talk about this anymore.
I want to know for certain this is going to work out.
My dad sighs. He looks out at the water to where they're building the Bay Bridge, two toothpicks held together by a thread of steel. He's quiet for a long time. Nobody knows how things will turn out. That's why they go ahead and play the game, Moose. You give it your all, and sometimes amazing things happen, but it's hardly ever what you expect. Now, he checks his watch. You can't go see the warden looking like that. Go put on a clean shirt.
I don't have one.
Cleaner, then. We don't put the laundry out till Wednesday. Comes back Monday.
Mom doesn't have to do it?
He shakes his head. The convicts do the washing here.
The convicts wash my shirts, as in murder convicts and kidnapper convicts, and then I'm supposed to wear them?
He laughs.
They darn socks, too?
Yes, as a matter of fact. Do a better job than your mom, too. Though don't you dare tell her I said that.
Murderers outsew my mother?
Apparently so, my dad laughs. 6. Sucker. Same day, Sunday, January 6th.